Michelle, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to my co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney, who's going to walk through a brief overview of today's session. Again, Michelle has been working here with our Superfund program, where she works on contaminated site remediation and reuse. She has been involved in researching information on mining site remediation technology, land reuse, and manages content and development for the ecological tools and mining pages on CLUIN. So, Michelle, you've been here at EPA for about 14 years, and I will gladly turn the reins over to you as my co-moderator.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Jean. I appreciate your introductions and orientation and all your help with all these great webinars. I welcome everyone to today's next installment of our webinar series on mining-related issues. This one we're doing over 2 days because there's so much information to talk about mine tailings, and we have some excellent presenters. I hope all of you will be able to attend both days, and if not, as Jean mentioned, the archives will be available so you can replay them in the very near future. So today we're going to talk about topics that are related to the design of mine tailing facilities, their operation and maintenance, and then also talk about some issues that have been experienced by our excellent presenters. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about the final closure and the covers of these tailings facilities. But before we get started with the meat of the presentation, I want to do a couple introductions. We have three presenters over these 2 days. Today we're going to hear from John Hillenbrand, who is the regional coordinator for mining activities, and he also provides technical expertise to mine site caseworkers within the Region 9 office, which is in our San Francisco office. And he also co-chairs the EPA's national mining team. John's a geologist, and he has 27 years of experience in the water quality and solid waste. And for the past 20 years, he's specialized in mining at EPA's Region 9 office, which covers California, Nevada, and Arizona. And then after John gives us some introductory remarks, we'll have our main presenter today, who is Jim Kuipers, and he's a mining environmental consultant and the principal consulting engineer with Kuipers and Associates based in Montana. Jim's worked on mining and environmental projects, including engineering design, permitting, operations, reclamation and closure, water treatment, financial assurance for over 30 years. And since 1996, his primary work has been as a consultant, providing engineering and other technical expertise to governmental and non-governmental organizations, all related to hard rock mining and other extractive resource environmental issues. So with that, I think I'm going to turn over our presentation to who's going to make a few remarks about mining and EPA and some of the work that we're doing in the Superfund program. So with that, John, I'd like to turn the presentation to you.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Good morning, everyone. My name is John Hillenbrand, and I was having some conversations with several colleagues a while ago when we were trying to discuss what were the most common problems that we find at mine sites from various perspectives. And there were many of them, of course, but one of the main ones is the understanding of tailings. From the beginning, from NEPA, through permitting, and through, if it need be, Superfund sites. And so tailings came up as one of the major issues that we deal with. So that's kind of the reason for today's webinar. And who knows what future webinars will cover, whether it's water treatment or other things. But today's, we're going to focus on tailings. So this webinar today is going to be kind of what you really need to know about mine tailings in the total of about 4 hours that we have. And it's for beginners as well as people who know a little bit more. Hopefully there'll be tidbits for more advanced people, but also it's got a broad overview for beginners. So luckily we have two really good experts in the area that can help us through these issues. So the first, I just have four slides here, but the first thing I think it's important to cover is mine life cycle. And from EPA program perspective, the three important parts of the mine life cycle is the permitting and development. Second part is the actual active mine life, and the third part is the closure and post-closure part of it. as Jim will get into later on, it's designing for closure is important. So understanding the life cycle and designing up front from, you can see in the top picture, before anything is done at all, to when it's actually open pit and mine life, and then at the very end at closure. We know a lot about closure. We know a lot about mine design, much more than we used to. So we can hopefully avoid problematic mines by understanding how to construct and close them. So we will be, through planning at modern mines, like I said, we can avoid legacy mine issues. The bottom photo is a mine site in Arizona where it's much older and it had no planning, no liners, no pre-construction design, and it's now a Superfund site. And as opposed to modern mines, even older ones, but modern mines hopefully have less problems and less issues, and this is our overall goal. This is my last slide. I just wanted to show you from a Superfund perspective, which is the program I work in. There's many different types of, at many different Superfund sites, we have different types of controls that we implement after we study and the site, we have a record decision on a site. And by way of reference, many of the sites, there's about 540 remedy components at about 88 different Superfund sites across the country. And of those 540 remedy components, 23% of them, or about 124 to date, have included some type of on-site disposal, capping, covering, and revegetation. And that's what Bill Albright's going to cover in the second part, the really important aspect of closure, which covers many, many of our sites. So with that said, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Kuipers.
Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. I'm hoping everybody can hear me. My name is Jim Kuipers, and it's my pleasure to present to you this today the section on mine tailings fundamentals, particularly focusing on mine tailings facility design and operations. By way of background, I grew up in a mining family. At 12 years old, I can remember being shown and in fact, being involved in a legacy mine tailings facility. I went to Montana School of Mines, Montana Tech as it's known today, received a degree in mineral process engineering, and commenced to work in the mining industry until 1995. During that time, what I found was, as the mineral processing engineer, we were the primary party at the mine site for the company, typically responsible not only for the operation of mine tailings facilities, but also for the design, construction, and closure of those facilities. There's been more involvement of other parties since that era, but at that time, it really was our responsibility to undertake matters with respect to mine tailings. Today, I work for a number of different organizations, as well as for regulatory agencies. I work both in the Canada and as well as the U.S., and in doing that work, I've had exposure to a number of different mine tailings facilities amounting to somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 that I've had the opportunity to review and be involved in the various aspects. So today I bring my perspective to you. I'm going to share some perspective that others have, as well as invite the perspective of participants in the questions and comments they might have. For this, what I consider, at least as an engineer, to be both a very complex as well as very interesting subject. So I just briefly want to go over the course outline. We're going to use a question format more or less in providing the information today. I want to talk about both the types of mine tailings and the characteristics of mine tailings, particularly differentiating those from other types of mine wastes, so we know particularly what we're talking about in this for this particular subject. We also want to talk about how mine tailings are stored. And I think in doing so, the best way that we can do so is to look at both, you know, what we call past, present, and future practice. And in doing that, it delves both into the legacy issues that we've had with mine tailings, but also what we know today and what we look at going forward in terms of practice for mine tailings storage. We're then going to dive into the critical features to consider in locating and designing mine tailings facilities. I've got a list here that we'll go through individually in detail when we get to that section. Similarly, we're going to go into how are mine tailings facilities constructed and operated, particularly with respect to a number of different construction approaches that can be used with respect to mine tailings. There are a number of different primary issues with operating tailings facilities we want to address, seepage, dust, long-term liability, as well as catastrophic failures. And then in particular with respect to catastrophic failures, we're going to discuss and I'll present some information with respect to the Mount Polly mine in British Columbia. And Mount Polly in many ways is a seminal event, in my opinion, for engineers, for owners, for regulators of tailings storage facilities. The independent expert panel findings that came out of that event, as well as what are likely to be future findings in the next few months, really have created an opportunity out of a challenge for the mining industry as well as others to adopt new practices to prevent those type of events. And then finally, we're going to wrap up today with a short synopsis on where I would suggest you need to go if you want to know more about tailings facility design and operations. Let me just start off by saying that under normal circumstances, to really provide a good understanding of tailings facilities to a layperson, I would suggest you need to undertake about 8 hours of education. We're going to try to fit all of that in a little bit more than 1 hour today and allow time for questions. If you have an opportunity, you'll want to go to places like the Edumine website. Edumine is a website where Jack Caldwell, Annie Robertson, and others have teamed up to provide training webinars that go into much more detail than we'll be able to go into today, as well as other resources that I'll identify later. So the first discussion we want to have is about what are mine tailings? And essentially, tailings are simply the waste materials that are remaining after we separate the valuable metal or minerals from an ore. And I want to emphasize ore. When we mine, at the mine site itself, we create ore and waste. And waste goes over into one pile, and that material is one of the mine sources, if you will, contamination, but it's not tailings. It's separate from tailings. Tailings are created when we take ore and process it by various means to create a valuable product out of one stream, and then the waste stream is tailings. So there are various types of mine tailings. The kind of more common mine tailings in the past would have been gravity process tailings. Today we don't see a lot of gravity processing, although there still is some. Flotation process tailings, from flotation processing in particular for copper ores, probably constitute the vast majority of tailings that are produced in current times, as well as have been produced in the past. We also have leach process tailings, and that can include cyanide leaching processes, sulfuric acid leaching processes, nitric acid leaching processes, as well as other processes that might involve essentially lixiviant dissolving the valuable commodity and removing it, therefore leaving behind a process tailings. Copper, gold, iron, lead, those are common tailings. Rare earth produces processing produces tailings, as does phosphate. And most other metal processing produces tailings, as well as power plants and fly ash process tailings, a lot of other things that could be considered tailings. The key thing is waste rock and overburden are separate from tailings and need to be discussed in a different context in most cases. Now, there are a number of different methods by which tailings are deposited, and those methods dictate in a lot of ways how we need to deal with tailings. The most common method, and this is one that has been common throughout history, is that of subaerial deposition shown in this slide. It's very important in this slide, and I'm trying to see if I can get the green cursor. that would allow me to show that. Thank you. I see it now. This slide has some important features that we need to familiarize ourselves when we talk about tailings. The first is this black pipeline going on here is the tailings delivery pipeline, and these pipes you see going out from that pipeline towards the tailings impoundment are spigots. The actual embankment is what the pipe lies upon, and then what you see here is what's called a beach, and that's a tailings beach. We'll talk more about that as we go on. And then in the back area here, we have essentially the supernatant or tailings water pond that usually in most cases would have a decant station and or some type of floating barge that would take this water and pump it back to the mill processing site where it would be recycled. The amount of water in a given tailings facility can vary drastically, as can the amount of beach that may be exhibited. And that's an aspect, or those are both aspects, that we'll talk about, and you'll see, you'll hear a lot of further discussion about as we talk about mine tailings. Now, subaqueous deposition is also something that we see. In this particular photograph, which is of a mine in Canada that I work at, we have subaqueous deposition happening in the bottom left via these pipes that you see here. This pipe is a tailings pipeline that goes essentially into a pit lake being used for tailings deposition, and that pipeline goes below the surface, thus it's subaqueous deposition. Now, I also included this slide because there's a dry stack tailings facility at this mine, and it's shown right here that I'm showing you with this arrow. You're going to hear a lot of talk about dry stack tailings, the benefits of dry stack tailings. This is a good example of where dry stack tailings is not a panacea, if you will, for all problems. This particular dry stack tailings was placed on top of an unstable foundation and has required a buttress in order to stabilize it. Now, dry stack, by all means, in this particular case is a good example, does not present the kind of catastrophic failures that we might be looking at with wet tailings in the same way that open pits don't present that challenge typically. But they do present other challenges that we can't ignore. The most common method of dealing with mine tailings is cycloning. And cycloning essentially is what is shown here. The figure on the right shows how cycloning works. The incoming arrow on the far right of the depiction right here essentially shows where the tailing slurry goes into a cyclone. Now, the tailing slurry goes in at a very high pressure, high velocity. And as it basically circulates within here, it essentially goes through gravity separation, and the bottom contains the coarse materials, and the fines go out the top. In addition to the fines going out of the top, the majority of the water goes out of the top, resulting in a concentration of coarse materials that's about 70% solids. As a result, it has fairly good strength. You can see here that it actually can mound up and be utilized in the construction, utilizing your tailings in the construction of the tailings embankment. And again, this method is very commonly used, particularly at very large copper mines. Now, thickened and paste tailings are beasts of their own. There's a lot of work that's been done on the two approaches to tailings. When you talk about paste tailings in particular, and that's what's being shown here on the left diagram or figure, you're really talking about something that has a very stiff consistency. It resembles a particular human waste product that I won't mention here, but it truly does in terms of the character. And that's what comes out of the other pipe. But when you talk about paste deposition on a larger scale, the photograph on the right is much more accurate. When we deposit paste, and this has a lot of aspects of paste that are important, but when we deposit paste, which is shown here in the foreground, we also need to still address water issues. It's not a panacea for all water issues, nor is dry stack for that matter. This figure shows, photograph correctly shows that there's a storage area down here for stormwater. And the stormwater, actually there's a dike here, and then there appears to be another pond, likely an overflow pond. But this allows for sediment control that still might occur or come from both paste tailings as well as dry stack tailings. You still have to do water management, but as those familiar with tailings might note from this photograph, the amount of water being managed is by orders of magnitude less than you typically would see for wet tailings. Now at the bottom of this slide, I've included some information in a table showing a comparison of tailings features. As you look at tailings further, and we're going to discuss filter tailings later, but when you compare tailings features, it's very important to look not only at how those features present themselves in terms of strength, but also in terms of power consumption, so we understand the cost that strength comes at. Conventional tailings coming out of the underflow or thickener runs approximately 50% solids, exhibits low strength, one could say no strength, but the power consumption is very low. The cost, if you will, of producing that type of tailings typically is well less than a dollar and can be 25% per ton or less. High-density tailings, which is achieved typically through a high-depth, high-rate thickener, can achieve a higher percent solids with some strength, but it's arguably not a strength that is terribly useful, also represents low power consumption. Now, when we get to paste, such as we're depicting here, the percent solids might typically range from 75 to 85%. The strength, though, is high. If you want to make it very high, you simply can add cement and get to that point. And it's very commonly used in underground mine backfill for that reason. And the power consumption increases from low to moderate, depending upon the method. I have seen methods of producing paste that are much higher in terms of power consumption, but I do believe there are methods that are more on the moderate, at least comparatively, scale. Now, filtered tailings, which typically is greater than 90% solids, meaning it's 10% moisture or less, has a very high strength. So for that reason, particularly from a geotechnical standpoint, it's very useful. It's not unlikely to fail. However, the power consumption in producing it is very high. In my estimation, it might be 90% higher, or 90%, if you will, of the cost compared to conventional tailings. I'm not really phrasing it right, but the cost might be 10 times higher than that of conventional tailings, in some cases even greater for that of filtered tailings. That power consumption comes at a cost of carbon production, and from an overall environmental picture, it may be that this has consequences that we haven't fully thought through. Now, this is a picture of dry stack tailings or filter press tailings. This is from the Greens Creek mine in Alaska. Dry stack tailings is very workable. You can see here that you can form shapes similar to waste rock piles with dry stack tailings. It also allows for more immediate or concurrent reclamation, and that's a big advantage, in my opinion, with respect to dry stack tailings. Instead of simply building a tailings impoundment and having to wait 15 years for it to fill, then reclaiming it at the end, dry stack allows for yearly concurrent reclamation to occur as the tailings are processed, stacked, built into ideally geomorphologically amenable shapes, and reclaimed. Now, another method that is oftentimes discussed, it hasn't been done in a great number of cases, is co-disposal of tailings with waste rock. This is a table from the GARD guide that shows some of the benefits as well as considerations of co-disposal. I'm not sure I would agree with all of the different generalizations that have been provided here. The main thing I would suggest is that it's something that if there is an advantage, it needs to be demonstrated, and then careful consideration will need to be given as to coordination of co-production of both waste rock and tailings, which in most cases is not as easy to accomplish as one might expect. So, how are mine tailings stored? This is a table that compares past, present, and future practice. In the past, it's fair enough to say that tailings were stored where it was most convenient. It was incidental, and there were few, if any, site-specific objectives other than to get rid of the material because it was inconvenient. The most common method, as I mentioned before, was subaerial deposition. There were various levels of engineered controls ranging from very minimal to none. As a result, we see that those type of tailings, which constitute a great number of Superfund sites, were very susceptible to seepage as well as to catastrophic events. It's not uncommon to see both occurring at mine tailing sites, particularly legacy sites. They're very difficult to reclaim and close. The cost per acre ranges somewhere from $50,000 to $100,000 if you care to use that type of approach. They inevitably do require long-term operations and maintenance. Now, present practice has changed considerably from that of the past. We today have engineering and regulatory objectives, although I would point out that those objectives or requirements are largely based on local practice rather than recognized international practice. As a result, we use a variety of deposition methods. Those methods have caused us to be less susceptible to catastrophic events and seepage, but it still occurs. And reclamation enclosure is today considered part of the project design in many cases. I would say to the greatest extent, it's done as a matter of convenience and not clearly as true intent. And otherwise, we would see a lot more tailings facilities being reclaimed concurrently, if nothing else on the embankments than we see today. Now, future practice, which we'll spend considerable more time discussing when we get to the Mount Polly section of this discussion, there we used best available technology, and by the way, it shouldn't say best professional technology, but rather best available technology, and best professional practice that really has regulatory objectives and other matters, more looking at that on an international scale. We don't want to forget local practice, particularly if it suggests more strict standards or approaches, but we also need to bring to the entire world, in my opinion, internationally, a set of high-level objectives that meet future practice standards. In the future, I expect we'll be seeing a lot more paste and dry stack tailings facilities being used. My hope is in the future, similar to that of the Mount Polly Independent Panel, that there is a zero tolerance for catastrophic events. And as a result of that, I would expect to see significant changes being made. Reclamation closure hopefully also will ideally be truly integrated in the project, and we'll see a lot more simultaneous reclamation going on rather than leaving these very large facilities for care and maintenance at the end and hoping the operator is still there to take care of that. Now, at the bottom of this slide, I've included two figures produced by Andy Robertson. I would suggest that folks need to listen to Andy way more than they do. Because he really understands the issue and I think is one of the few people who has been able to point out where we're likely to end up if we're not careful. The first figure on the left shows the dam height increase with time. And when you look at this graphic, if we consider the historic period to be, for example, 1900 to approximately 1960, what we see is we really hadn't gotten to the point where we were building these structures at any greater height than 200 meters, approximately 600 feet. At the same time, when we look at our risk, by approximately 1960, we had increased the risk to, from a relative measure, 0.1, or a little less than 0.1. Now, if we step forward to 2010 in terms of dam height increases, basically, what Andy had projected is we're looking at increases in the range of 300 to 400 meters. And in particular, this is speaking to the oil sands dams that are being built in Canada, which are some of the largest structures that have ever been built on Earth. Looking at the risk, around 2010, we get to approximately a one-to-one risk. Well, whether Andy intended to or not, and I know he did not intend to, he, in a way, predicted Mount Polly, because in approximately this time, this graph shows that one-to-one risk, Mount Polly happened. quite a bit of irony, but also some interest in that projection. The next discussion we want to go into are identification of the critical features that we need to consider when we're talking about mine tailings facilities. And we'll go through each one of these individually. The first that we need to take into account is hydrology. The hydrology of a tailings pile is very important. In hydrology, we're always talking about the interaction of the tailings and surface water. When we have precipitation occur on top of tailings, the simple matter is we can erode those tailings as well as transport contaminated water off the tailings into surface streams. And that's what this slide is intended to depict. It's a relatively simple concept, and one we all see. Now, I would also note this slide shows a hydrogeologic or groundwater feature where it says infiltration from tailings pile. I'm going to get to a later slide where I explain to you that slide is incorrect. It should say exfiltration from the tailings pile. We really have infiltration into the tailings and exfiltration from the tailings, just for later. Now, hydrogeology is a study of the groundwater interactions with the underlying geology or bedrock features. And this slide is very useful. It's from the GARD guide, and it depicts a lot of different aspects of a mine tailings facility that are important to realize. The first is we're showing an embankment here, and this embankment is essentially a modified centerline approach, I believe. I may be incorrect. This is an area that I oftentimes find confusing as well as others find confusing. But this is essentially the embankment, and then it shows the deposition of tailings occurring. This would appear to be a subaerial discharge of the tailings slurry occurring behind the embankment, and then we have the tailings forming a beach, although I have to say they should have depicted a little more of a beach here, ideally. But you have the tailings forming the beach and then continuing on below the water cover that we saw previously in another slide. One of the things that's very important here is this depiction shows fine and coarse tailings, coarse ranging over to fine. It also shows a liner in this particular case. One might assume a geomembrane liner or a clay liner. What I also find very interesting and important is it depicts quite accurately seepage occurring through the fine and coarse fraction of the sands, which actually, in many cases, I've met other consultants who would suggest that that prevents any seepage from occurring. It certainly decreases the seepage, but by no means prevents it. And in the same way, liners, as we'll discuss later, they do not prevent seepage, but rather they decrease it. So I find this particular graphic to be very interesting as well as very accurate, useful for one to keep in mind when thinking about how mine tailings work with respect to groundwater interaction. Now, a lot of emphasis, particularly recently, has been given to the geotechnical aspects of mine tailings, particularly with respect to Mount Polley, because what we saw there was a failure that related to the geotechnical aspects. I would recommend for anybody who wants to spend more time in this, because we could spend a great deal of time today, that they first go to the Edge of Mine course offered by Jack Caldwell, Geotechnical Engineering for Mine Geo-Waste Facilities. It not only addresses mine tailings, but waste rock, other facilities as well. What I'm listing here essentially are the common tests, and there are a great number of common tests, all of which are intended to provide different information to the geotechnical engineer. Atterberg limits are done. We look at specific gravity. Gradation is another common test. And what this graphic on the bottom shows is the gradation for a number of different tailings in Canada. And we're showing things here everywhere from a dry tailings that is relatively coarse, if you will, to a very fine tailings being produced for the same mine, the reserve mine. Here on this graphic. Now, I oftentimes look at the 70th percentile or 80th percentile passing point, which is right in here. And what you'll see is predominantly the tailings are a sand to sand silt, or even clay in some cases, type composition. And there's a very tight band in here that most have. So that we don't see within tailings a great deal of differentiation. There is some tendency now today to create finer and finer tailings as grinding processes become more efficient. But this, in general, shows what you would expect to see in terms of gradation for tailings. Now, I've also listed here some additional common tests that are done for geotechnical engineering, permeability, density, etc. At the bottom, I provided a table that is from the Mount Polley Tailings Storage Facility Foundation analysis conducted by the expert panel that investigated the Mount Polley failure. And I would just note that this shows how one essentially uses the different data that's collected in order to look at different stratigraphic units and subunits. And very importantly, by looking at different subunits, the panel, as we'll discuss later, identified what we're calling a glacial lacustrine unit, or GLU, that was responsible for the Mount Polley failure. Now, the approach is to take the various information we get from those analysis, or testing, I should say, and then subject those as variables into stability analysis. And the stability analysis is typically approached in one of two ways, or I should say in two ways. The first is looking at static failures. And static failures involve failures of the foundation within the tailings itself, of the embankment materials, and are oftentimes related to seepage. And static failures are the type of failures that are by far and away most common. They can be due to both design errors as well as operational errors and other aspects. Seismic stability really relates to earthquake type events, and therefore it's looked at specifically with respect to what is the anticipated impact of those events. So when we talk about seismic events, we typically want to begin with considering magnitude, the size or Richter scale of the earthquake. Very important is the distance to the fault. If we're literally only a few feet or hundreds of feet from a fault as compared to tens or hundreds of miles from a fault, that can greatly diminish or otherwise intensify the impacts that might occur in a seismic event. The underlying soil conditions are also very, very important. If we have soil conditions such as sandy soils that are liquefied, and there are certain regions in the U.S., for example, that are known to be very susceptible to high failure events in the event of earthquakes because of those conditions. And I might also point out that those conditions are that which tailings are mimicking. That can cause very large failures resulting in large movements. Tailings, as I indicate here, the type of tailings, nature of the tailings are very important, and the disposal method as to tailings can be very important when we talk about seismic events. We could spend easily a day, and at some point probably should spend a day, talking about tailings geochemical aspects. And I've done other work with Ann Maist in producing a 2006 prediction guide. The GARD guide goes in depth into mining-influenced water, as well as a number of SME manuals and guidebooks that have been produced over the past couple of years. Very briefly, though, I just want to mention the key geochemical aspects we would need to consider. What we look at today, unlike in the past, is the knowledge that mining influences water. It influences water in a number of different ways that I've listed here. The first and most common that folks are familiar with is that of acid drainage. Acid drainage, acid mine drainage, acid rock drainage, as it's commonly referred to, it results in reduced pH and elevates the sulfates and metals. In the past, there have been a great number of mine sites with acid drainage, and I would suggest there is a great volume of information as to both the identification, prediction, and treatment of acid drainage. More recently, we've recognized that neutral and saline drainage is, in my opinion, just as important. Neutral and saline drainage is typically exhibited with an increased pH, although the pH can be neutral as well. But importantly, what we see is elevated total dissolved solids and metals. And in particular, we see arsenic, selenium, and other negatively charged metals, commonly referred to as metalloids, that are associated with neutral and saline drainage. Now, when you consider, and if you were to look at all the different modern mine, active mine today situations where water treatment is being required, and I might add in maybe the last 10 to 20 years of closed mines, what you would see in my experience is that the cost and the need for treatment to effectively ameliorate neutral and saline drainage is equal to that of acid drainage. And I think that's a finding, if you will, that many people are not aware of, but really the importance of neutral and saline drainage to that of mine-influenced water is equal to that of acid drainage. Now, a third aspect we have is chemical-influenced drainage. That includes things like cyanide, sulfuric acid, and include other toxic substances, chemicals that basically are toxic. Finally, I've listed here long-term as an aspect of mine-influenced water. We have to deal with drainage long-term, and it's very difficult to predict and therefore determine what exactly is necessary to deal with drainage from mine tailings long-term. We do a great deal of effort to predict it with static tests, kinetic tests, geochemical tests, other things, but the absolute ability to know what is going to come out isn't quite there yet, and it's an aspect we have to deal with. Another thing about long-term that we're still trying to figure out with tailings is degradation of physical properties, such as that of liners. We're really looking at today those liners as having one performance characteristic. It's probably impossible to think of those liners as maintaining that characteristic over geologic time in particular. A very important aspect, in my opinion, and I, again, would reiterate, I've spent time as a mine operator responsible for the not only the design but the construction and oversight. And I would suggest to folks that, at least in my opinion as a mine operator, I didn't defer that responsibility to the engineer of record. I still believed on behalf of the owner it was my responsibility to ensure the performance of the engineer of record. Therefore, I think there's a real emphasis that needs to be given to construction oversight as well as construction quality assurance and quality control. And rather than belabor that, I would only say that without that being incorporated, and from a regulatory standpoint, it is frequently either not required and almost always not described well, we can't be assured that mine tailings facilities are properly constructed. And that's a good example of where something needs to be done. If you want an example of where it has been done, and I think done quite well, I would suggest looking to the New Mexico copper rules, where they have parts of those rules. I certainly don't agree with all parts of those rules, I have to tell you. But the parts of those rules that describe the requirements for construction oversight and QAQC would serve as a very good example of what should be done, at least from a regulatory standpoint in terms of requiring construction oversight. In terms of operations, there is one organization that has really pulled things together in that regard. That's the Mining Association of Canada. Just for those not aware, the various companies, as well as engineering firms in Canada, were involved in, one might suggest, responsible for a large number of tailings facilities failures that occurred worldwide in the past. They came together as a result of those failures, recognized their the need, if you will, to produce some guidance, and did so. The MAC guides, which include a guide to management, a manual for operation, maintenance, and surveillance, and a guide for auditing and assessment of tailings facilities, really are the best example I can give of current best practice with respect to operational practice. And any company that is not following that guidance, and I would suggest following it very willingly and to the letter, really isn't practicing in the 21st century. Now, I want to go into discussion of catastrophic events for a brief moment here, and then again later with Mount Polly. But what I have here is a tailings facility hazard ranking, and really this is a, I should say, a dam facility hazard ranking that's been done by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Office of FEMA. And that should be FMEA, Failure Management Emergency Services, I forget. I guess it is FEMA. Okay, sorry. But FEMA has produced this classification, which is shown in this table. It essentially consists of three hazard potential classifications, low, significant, and high. And as you can see here, those classifications are based on loss of human life as well as economic, environmental, lifeline losses. The low and significant classifications are characterized by no expected loss of human life, and they're differentiated in terms of the other losses, in terms of one being limited to the owner and the other being outside of that of the owner. High classifications under this rating system are limited to those where loss of life is probable, one or more is expected, and there is, but it's not necessary, an economic, environmental, or lifeline loss. In terms of trying to apply these rankings to consideration of mine tailings facilities, I personally don't think they're very useful. They don't go much beyond what you see presented right here. Now, I apologize for the size of the text on this slide. It's really not large enough for me to go through it in detail. But needless to say, the Canadian Dam Association has recently come out with a mine tailings facility guidance. They produced a considerably more detailed approach to dam classification and also mine tailings facility classification. And I'm showing that here. They have five different areas or dam classes that are shown here. They look at different values or the same values, but it's structured in a different way slightly than that of FEMA. What I would suggest is most important about the CDA classification is it in turn points to the frequency with which inspections and maintenance needs to occur, in which independent reviews need to occur, in which various other matters critical to maintaining dam safety need to occur. And so really this isn't just a classification, but also one that points to, as a result of these classifications, what needs to happen to assure the safe operation and stability of these facilities. I would suggest it's the type of thing either the U.S. needs to adopt, as well as other countries, or we need to produce something of similar import as that of CDA in the U.S. for our use. There are a number of other considerations that we need to look at with respect to mine tailings, climate, terrain, use of open pits, and return of water facilities amongst them. Climate can make a great deal of difference. I think it's very important to note that when we talk about facilities like we might expect to see in British Columbia, this depiction the picture on the far right bottom is more accurate for that type of tailings facility scenario, whereas the picture on the left-hand side of a tailings facility in Arizona is more accurate for depiction of an arid scenario. It also, these different photographs, the two speak to differences in terrain. And climate and terrain can dictate to a huge extent what you need to do for tailings. I think one has to be very careful in terms of the expert panel's recommendations for British Columbia as to whether a different climate or different locational situation may have resulted in a different recommendation. Now, this also shows the use of open pits. And I would suggest that wherever possible, wherever proper, and hopefully more situations are proper than not, open pits should be used for the storage of tailings. It accomplishes two things. One, it provides a stable source of storage for tailings, but also it utilizes that space that otherwise is oftentimes left unreclaimed or empty. It fills it back with tailings and then allows for very effective reclamation of open pits to be performed. And so the opportunity to backfill open pits with tailings should never be ignored. We also need to always consider return water facilities. Tailings facilities should utilize a principle of recycling of that water and maintenance of minimal water. Again, I couldn't emphasize often enough in this presentation water management as a critical feature of mine tailings facilities, particularly the wet tailings facilities, which we oftentimes see today. Now, there are a number of different ways in which tailings facilities can be constructed and operated. And what I'm going to do now is just walk through those different ways. This graphic shows the different types of mine tailings discharge systems. And this is primarily applicable to subaerial deposition. When we talk about subaerial deposition, although it may also be applicable to subaqueous, I should say, but primarily, again, to subaerial, we have different ways that we do it, including single-point deposition, multiple-point. We can have continuous or automated linear systems. And then there are some situations where you see radial systems. Each of these has its advantages and disadvantages. I'm not going to go into each one of these in detail today, but I would encourage you that this is a good example of where you need to consider those advantages and disadvantages relative to the site-specific objectives you're trying to accomplish with the tailings disposal method. Now, we'll hear a lot, or you will hear a lot, I should say, and I've heard a lot throughout my career about upstream centerline and downstream construction. And literally, for as many tailings facilities as I'm aware of, there are as many different tailings facility construction methods. I've encountered what I would term as modified upstream centerline and downstream construction of various types that differentiate themselves a bit from these drawings at various facilities. But as shown here, and I'll see if I can get the cursor up again. I haven't quite figured out how to do that. There it goes. Okay, thank you. As you can see here, what's depicted are three different types as provided by Steve Vick. The first type that he's showing here is upstream construction, essentially where as the dam is constructed, you can see each subsequent lift works its way upstream or into the tailings. The middle picture is that of centerline construction. Now, the centerline of the dam essentially moves, if you will, downstream. So this is where I oftentimes look at that or would myself think of that as a modified centerline approach. And then the bottom depiction is that of a downstream, or what's commonly done for a water retention type dam. Many tailings facilities end up being water retention type dams, I should say. Paste and dry stack tailings facilities are very common today. They seem to be much more common as we go further north. I see a lot of these facilities in Alaska. This is a good example of one early in the stage of construction at the Pogo mine that shows dry stack, dry stack tailings, filter tailings that are offloaded by trucks being graded and located in this valley location. A very stable type situation, I should say, and one in which, ideally reclamation would have occurred to a significant extent by now. With respect to other techniques, there's the question of lined or unlined tailings. And what I'm showing here is a tailings impoundment that I'll leave unnamed, mainly because there's perhaps a safety violation. But this was long ago being shown here. But nonetheless, the question with lined or unlined tailings, first, from an operational standpoint, is that of do they leak or not? We'll discuss more, but tailings always leak, or I should say liners always leak. Tailings impoundments literally always leak. And the real question is what benefit you gain by lining a pond, as well as consideration of the difficulties of closure of these ponds. And I think it's fair game. I know different people have strongly held different opinions, but the idea of whether we should line or shouldn't mine tailings impoundments is fair game. The easy way to eliminate this issue would be simply to eliminate wet tailings impoundments. Then we could focus the discussion differently. So I want to go for a few minutes into the primary issues that exist with operating tailings facilities that are listed here. The first slide that I'm showing here presents some thoughts on design. And I might mention that I've gone through other folks' thoughts. I've cribbed a bit and stolen a bit from those and then put them in my own words here. But I would emphasize the following when we talk about design. The first is we need to obey the law of physics, the laws of physics, I should say. Gravity exists, stability matters concern, and far too often in the designs I've seen, the matter of geotechnical stability is more or less done simply as a verifying or cursory matter and not as something that is a hard examination. And I think going forward, we need to look very hard at geotechnical aspects such as represented by the laws of physics, quite simply. The second bullet I have here, I could use a little different approach, but stuff happens. Things always happen that we don't expect to happen. Earthquakes occur, other catastrophic events happen. Humans make accidents, Mother Nature provides circumstances that we didn't plan for. So we need to go ahead and consider that things aren't going to happen the way we want them to and consider failures. We also have to address the fact that time will take its toll. Many of these tailings facilities are projected to be closed and walked away from. And I think there's a great concern that erosion, other long-term impacts such as seepage will show up. We'll need to address that. And to really get to an effective design, we have to look at closure. And that's really what this is emphasizing. Water management. If I were a regulator, an operator, an owner, and I saw excess water in my tailings facility, I would take every measure necessary, including that of an emergency discharge, to overcome that situation. Folks, we just simply have to quit screwing around with excess water in facilities that were not intended to manage water, but instead were intended to manage tailings. I just can't emphasize the degree to which this is a key aspect, and we'll talk about that a bit more later when we look at Mount Polly. Economic feasibility is emphasized by industry way too much, in my opinion. What they need to realize is the least cost option may not be the least cost option, particularly when you look at catastrophic events. I've seen too many situations where we did have liners on impoundments, and we went with a sub or inferior material or thickness of material rather than thicker to save money, but then it just leaked. So what did we accomplish? So I really think the economic feasibility approach needs to be reconsidered. And then with respect to design, whether we like it or not, I think without some level of law and regulation requiring some minimal design, ideally contributed to heavily by the engineering community, needs to be put in place. Because as we see far too often, even the best intended folks can take shortcuts and cause unintended consequences. I might mention that as an engineer, I think one of the most important things we can do is to pull our head out of the sand and admit that we're not perfect and that things that we're not planning on can happen. That's been recognized for a long time by folks like Ralph Peck. And Peck is one of the, if you will, key figures in the history of geotechnical engineering, soil mechanics. And he is one of the first to really put down, if you will, in words, the observational method. I would emphasize some key aspects of that method. The first is you need to establish at least the general nature, pattern, and properties of the deposits. This doesn't mean in detail, but when we fail to identify or understand the nature of what we're dealing with in terms of underlying foundations, for example, we get in trouble. We need to assess the most probable conditions and then the most unfavorable deviations from these conditions. Engineers don't like to second-guess themselves. In fact, we're to some extent taught not to do that. However, we need to not just look at most probable conditions, but be willing to look at unfavorable conditions and subject our designs to those conditions. You need to make sure that those conditions are compatible with the available data. If you haven't collected data, then you need to go beyond just a simple literature research to establish your parameters. One needs to take a much more conservative approach than that affords. And then, regardless of how careful a job we do up front, things can still happen, and we need to select a course of action that allows for observational findings to be different from those that are predicted. And as a result, we need to modify that design. And again, I would encourage folks to realize that no matter what discussion we have, predictions of stability, predictions of geochemistry, all these things, they have high levels of uncertainty with them. And very important as we go forward in construction of anything is that we use the observational method. Now, there are all types of discussions concerning mine tailing seepage. Again, this is the type of discussion that would warrant 30 to 60 minutes by itself. I just want to focus, though, on a few key terms. We really need to look at it this way. Infiltration is water that seeps into the tailing. So we might, you know, look at infiltration as being the water, when water that's overlying the tailings, whether it's from a mine pool or from meteoric events, it's the water that seeps into the tailings itself. And it might seep into an embankment as well. The through flow is the water that seeps from the top of the tailings through to the bottom of the tailings. And then exfiltration is simply the water that then seeps from the tailings. But I think it's very helpful if we try to use these type of terms when we speak about it. Now, when we think of types of seepage, a tailings facility it typically exhibits two primary types of seepage in terms of infiltration. We can have infiltration from the beach area, where we have meteoric water falling on top of that beach, and then working as through flow, and infiltrating and then acting as through flow through the tailings. We can also have infiltration coming from the pool of water, the processed water above the tailings, that also infiltrates and then flows through the tailings. Both of these types can result in exfiltration, or water that seeps from the tailings. Now, I would also mention that in many cases, embankments are also built of tailings material and or can be built of waste rock that might contain contamination. So we might also have embankment infiltration as well as exfiltration of seepage from embankment adding to this picture. Now, the main thing we look at with seepage are groundwater impacts. And some tailings designs are actually intended to seep, then have groundwater capture involved in them and return the water. Others, the groundwater impacts simply are unintended. Again, I would point out very importantly that one of the key ways to address seepage, to understand seepage, is to look at the water balance that's occurring for a tailings facility. Now, another aspect or issue, if you will, of mine tailings is dust. I've toured by, and many of you also have toured by tailings facilities, and all too often, particularly on windy days, you see dust, excessive dust, but essentially all is termed as nuisance dust coming from tailings. I've dealt with it at Superfund sites, at active mine sites, all kinds of different sites, and it's a plague. What I will tell you is there really is no excuse for it. There are current mitigation measures in terms of maintaining a water cover to covering the tailings with surfactant, covering it with gravel to reduce, if not entirely mitigate, dust. Rather than arguing about whether it should or shouldn't be done, operators should simply be doing what's necessary to control dust from tailings impoundments. And similarly, I would suggest that regulators, if they're responsible for tailings impoundments, need to be taking care of this matter similarly. Dust has given tailings a bad name where I really think it didn't need to, at least in some cases. Now, the other aspect of mine tailings that I want to make sure we touch upon is that of long-term liability, where we have releasing contaminants. That can occur to groundwater and surface water. We have to do dust prevention. Institutional controls is oftentimes an aspect where we need to maintain the regulatory and legal controls, such as land use covenants, that need to go on with these type of facilities open long term. And then, of course, we have maintenance requirements in terms of cover and revegetation requirements, stormwater conveyances, and access. And I'll talk more about these requirements as they relate to reclamation and closure tomorrow. Now, we want to conclude today's session with some information on catastrophic failures. This is a graphic that shows, and this is actually from a study produced by the International Commission on Large Dams back in 2001, and it's the tailings dam's risk of dangerous occurrences. And on the right-hand side, if I can get the cursor back again, thank you. On the right-hand side, I've included a couple of figures from that report. And I believe these are very important figures to consider. The top figure, figure 7, shows active dams and inactive dams and the number of incidents relative to the type of failures that occur. Things like overtopping, slope stability, earthquake, foundation, seepage, structural and other failures. Now, we're looking at active dams versus inactive dams. And when you look at each one of these categories, what you see is that the risk of failure is much, much higher for active dams, or the incidence of failure, I should say, is much higher for active dams than that of inactive dams. In fact, there are some failure modes in which that the occurrence at inactive dams is relatively rare. So when we talk about catastrophic failures, the primary area we're looking at is active dams. Then when you look at the types of failures in the same way relative to whether they were caused by, if you will, design failures or by accidents, what you see is there's a much more even split between these two. And so what we see in dam failures is they're caused by both failures of human operations, if you will, to either adhere to design or adhere to the operational requirements of the facility, or they occur due to accidents. Or I should say the failures are due to engineering oversight failures where the design didn't take into account, and the accidents are really due to the human errors that may occur. Apologize for that mix-up. Okay, what I want to do is take some closing minutes here and go through the Mount Polly tailings breach that occurred in British Columbia. For those of you who don't know, the Mount Polly mine had a tailings facility that was used to store flotation tailings. It's a copper gold mine. On August 4, 2014, in the middle of the night at approximately 2 to 3 a.m., the mine tailings facility failed and it breached, resulting in the loss of about 15 million cubic meters of tailings. This is a breach that occurred in the middle of the night with little, perhaps no warning whatsoever. In terms of prior monitoring that might have detected it. So it's something that fortunately it didn't kill anybody, but it very easily could have. Following the breach, the British Columbia government formed an independent review panel of three geotechnical experts, Steve Bick, Dirk Van Ziel, and Norty Morgenstern, three eminent geotechnical engineers, to investigate and report on that breach. I actually had the honor of serving as the liaison and representative to the Williams Lake Indian Band and Soda Creek or Zatzel Indian Band. They were the two Indian bands that were most directly affected by this breach. And I had the opportunity to have some interface of a limited with the expert panel that I can tell you was life-changing, both professionally as well as personally. However, they went ahead, did their work, they delivered their report, and that report's available. I would strongly recommend if you have the opportunity, have time, to go through that report in detail, as it's very enlightening, very educational, and certainly is something that, again, I would point out this as being a seminal event. Now, this is the video of the actual tailings breach. And I believe I'll need to ask the moderator to go ahead and fire it up.
I'm going to come on the line here and just provide a few reminders for this video portion. There is no relevant audio that you'll need for this portion of the video. I believe Jim will provide a brief narration via the phone and online audio, so you really just need to pay attention to what you're about to see on the screen. If you have technical difficulties viewing that movie, feel free to use the Q&A window to let me know. Jim, I'm going to start playing. You can tell me if you need me to pause it.
Okay, thank you. This video is a rare video. I don't think there's one similar anywhere in the world of a tailings breach that was taken by a helicopter shortly following, actually the day after, morning after the breach occurred. And what you see here is a massive volume of tailings discharging from the facility through the breach down into a series of lakes and creeks and rivers, causing quite a catastrophic impact. We've never seen before how a breach works going through. You can actually see in this video the core of the dam as well as other features. A key aspect of this was that there was a huge amount of water stored in these tailings. As you look at this video, you can see large amounts of tailings liquefying and, if you will, almost capping, similar to a glacier or something, into the stream and becoming part of the slurry leaving the facility. If there had been a large beach, much less water at this facility, the consequences on the amount of material flowing out would have been much, much different. There's more information on the expert panel website, more video there and elsewhere. So if you're interested in seeing this actual event as it occurred.
Okay, Jim, your slide should be back up in just a moment.
Thank you. And now we just need to be able to advance if we can. Okay. Now, what I've got here are a few slides showing the findings of the expert panel. As I mentioned earlier, essentially what they found was that the previous foundation investigations and associated site characterization did not identify the glacial lacustrine unit layer below the foundation, beneath the foundation, which caused the breach. Therefore, it didn't take into account the complexity of that feature in the TSF foundation. One of the aspects that was very ironic was the failure was triggered because at the time of the failure, there was a 1-3 horizontal to 1 vertical slope on the constructed Rockville tailings dam, the downstream slope. It's ironic because if that same downstream slope had been flattened 2-1 horizontal to 1 vertical, as was proposed in the original design, and as I would point out as is necessary for reclamation of that facility, then the failure would have been avoided. So simply if the facility had been designed for concurrent reclamation of the embankment as well as to design, we would not have had this failure. But as it is, that's not the case. So what I think this did more than anything is it created an opportunity for three individuals who represent a lot of thought, a lot of process that have been given into tailings impoundments over the years to come together with some recommendations. The fact that they did so in such a bold manner, in my opinion, is exceptional. I certainly and others don't agree with all of their findings and recommendations, but having said that, I give great respect to the efforts, and particularly their willingness to put forth what they did. One of the very interesting things that they undertook was to go into the tailings dam records of the British Columbia regulatory agencies and investigate what the previous occurrence of tailings dam failures had been. Somebody had made the statement in British Columbia that there had never been a previous tailings dam failure. Well, what they discovered was there had been a lot of failures. Those failures just hadn't made headlines. And when they got done, they were able to come up with a statistical probability suggesting that there's approximately a 1 in 600 chance of failure in any given year of tailings facilities based upon the British Columbia data. Now, when you have over 100 wet tailings storage dams in your regulatory jurisdiction and you have a 1 in 600 chance of those failing in any given year, then what it means is about every 5 years, 10 to 15 years, you can expect from 1 to 2 events to happen, Mount Polly being an example. Now, the question they were asked was, what can they do to prevent that? Well, simply the panel said, we can't continue to have business as usual because that will mean we have a similar event, or at least a failure of significance, every 5 years or so. So what they said was, if you want to get to zero, which really is what we need to do, because continued failures can't be allowed to happen for a variety of reasons as stated here, we need to go a different direction. And so they said we needed to add a new dimension, that dimension being technology. And what they pointed to, as shown in this slide, is essentially using best available tailings technology with three, if you will, BAT principles being employed. The first is that we need to eliminate surface water from the impoundment. The idea of combining water storage with tailing storage, while it has been common to past practice, simply needs to be ended. I would wholly agree with that to the extent it's technically feasible. We need to do so. They also recommended we need to promote unsaturated conditions in the tailings with drainage provisions. To me, this is an absolute requirement for closure, and the extent it can be accomplished during operations certainly makes sense. And then finally, they suggested we need to achieve dilatant conditions. In other words, they're no longer changing throughout the deposit by compaction. Really, that's probably only going to be easily possible with filtered tailings. I think we can perfect methods to do that with paste tailings. But otherwise, really to accomplish these three components, we need to look at paste or dry tailings. Basically, the idea is we need to reduce the number of tailings that could be subject to failure. Short of that, we don't accomplish the goal. So they had a number of different directions. I think it's important for folks trying to currently address existing tailings impoundments to look at this. What they're suggesting is, more than anything, is rather than retrofit these, we need to rely upon what we instead know today as best practices. And I would point again to the Mining Association Academy guidelines for operation and management, as well as other information that needs to be adhered to as we go forward in order to minimize the possibility of failure at existing tailings. And then, as they're suggesting, new tailings, basically their suggestions of best available technology should be applied to any new tailings facility, including expansions at existing facilities, I would suggest. Now, the expert panel also made a number of other recommendations that I won't go into in detail here, but I do think are worth mentioning. One of the things they did that needs to be emphasized is they took the corporation to task, and they really pointed to corporate governance as having a responsibility to make sure that what's going on with their operations, with their engineering record and others, is not just assumed to be good, but is second-guessed, if you will. And so that's a key part of this. The panel recognized that they need to take responsibility, the corporation. Some key recommendations they made include that of an independent tailings review board, which is a very good idea for any of these facilities. I would add that you need to do a failure modes effects analysis and develop an adaptive management plan for these type of facilities. They addressed regulatory aspects. I think that's the one place I disagree with them most strongly as to whether or not the regulators had a greater degree of responsibility for what happened. They addressed professional practice as well as mentioned the CDA guidelines. So I want to conclude by talking about, just briefly mentioning, if you will, where I would suggest you go for more information. As I mentioned earlier, the InfoMine, EduMine website and the courses that are offered on that website, in my opinion, are the best available information source for mining professionals, for regulators, for the interested public to obtain that information. It does come at a cost, but I would suggest that that cost compared to the value in the information you get, the usability of information is quite reasonable. you need to get a hold of, if you do this type of work, the Canadian Dam Association, as well as Canadian Mining Association documents I've mentioned. That should be Mining Association Canada, by the way. I believe those, for anybody working on tailings facilities on a regular basis, should be, if you will, your desktop guidances that you refer to on a regular basis. I mentioned the information from FEMA. Now, in the United States, and this is also true in provinces in British Columbia, as well as elsewhere, the local jurisdiction relative to dam safety regulations is very important. And in most cases, there may not be national regulation, but there should be, at a minimum, state or provincial regulations that are equivalent to any national regulations that you might imagine. But I do have to say, in reviewing a variety of different state and provincial regulations, they vary considerably. And this is a good example of where a more international regulatory overarching approach may be advantageous. Finally, I would recommend, as I've said, that folks spend time with the Mount Polly Independent Review panel site. I want to thank everybody for their patience listening to me. This is just one person's view of mine tailings. But I do look forward to your questions, and thank you again for your time.
Great. Thanks, Jim. That was a very good presentation, and we did get a number of questions that came in while you were speaking. And I want to remind everyone, you can use the Q&A pod to submit questions, and I guess at this point we can take some time to – Jim, would you like me to read some questions to you, and you can provide responses?
Sure, you bet.
Okay, great. One participant had asked the question, when you use the term tailings, for spent, do you use that term for spent ore from heap leach processing?
You know, I appreciate that question because I really left heap leaching and dump leaching out of the description of what is or isn't tailings. No, I do not. It's very important to consider that heap leaching is done in a different manner. Now, many of the same design characteristics, certainly consideration of water balance, consideration of stability, various other aspects are equally important and equally applicable to heap leach facilities. But because of their nature, generally having a much coarser gradation, ranging from sand to, in most cases, gravel, they're quite different from tailings, and also the facilities as they're constructed generally are also quite different from that of tailings.
Okay, thank you. Another person that asked, I guess when you were talking about risk, they asked a question about why is the scale of risk up to 1,000?
Well, I'm trying to think where they're talking. Probably, I'm wondering if they're talking about the Canadian Dam Association graphic and if we might be able to go up to that.
Sure. Do you know which slide that was on? It came in early on, so.
Okay.
Let's see.
Let's see, a couple more.
Oops. That one?
I'm not sure, and I'm thinking here. When I spoke of risk, I actually misspoke, and it's really number of incidents that are shown on this graphic. But I actually don't think that's probably what the question was. Maybe we could go on and ask the questioner to clarify which graphic they were referring to.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. If the person who asked that question, if you could submit any clarifying follow-up on what slide you were referring to, we will try to respond to you. Okay, we're getting a number of more questions in. Someone wants to know if the saline drainage problems is associated with carbonate minerals or another mineral form.
To the best of my knowledge, it's certainly not exclusive to carbonate minerals. When we look at it, we see a lot of association, for example, saline drainage with the existence of added chemicals. For example, when we do heat bleaching or cyanide processing, we add lime and increase the pH of the slurry, as tailing slurry in this particular case. with respect to selenium, it appears that it actually has some similarities to that of acid drainage, but in a more neutral drainage format where we see continual generation of selenium as it oxidizes. And we essentially, as it oxidizes, it's oxidizing at a more neutral or a neutral pH, if you will. So I would say that in many cases it's associated with carbonate minerals, but certainly not in all cases.
Okay, great. I guess we're getting some clarification from a number of people about the risk number of 1,000, and they're indicating that it was presented on this slide 11.
Okay. You know, I unfortunately haven't discussed this particular graphic with Andy. I think, but I suspect the way he would describe it is he was really presenting this as a relative risk and didn't intend to suggest that the risk was in fact one-to-one in 2010, but rather was comparing risk relative to the height of dams. I think just coincidentally it happened to hit the risk ratio of one in 2010, as I suggested.
Okay.
But what I can do, that's a good example of something I could certainly ask Andy for clarification. I know he'd be glad to provide it.
Okay. Okay, great. And perhaps folks that have more questions about that can follow up with you. We have your contact information on the main seminar page, and it's actually will be associated with the archive for the webinar also. We have a question from a participant who wants to know if we can assume that managing dust from the thickened paste tailings in semi-arid areas is still a lot easier than managing water for wet tailings?
that questioner must know something about tailings, I would suggest. That's a good example of where we're going to need to look at the contradictions, if you will, presented between geotechnical issues and environmental issues. I would propose that the control of dust will present a very significant issue, particularly in any kind of areas with significant wind, for paste tailings as well as for dry tailings both. Paste tailings may be more difficult simply because it may be difficult to get out on the material and apply mitigating measures. At the same time, if we can do those methods in a way that achieves more concurrent reclamation, there's a good chance we can reduce that dust significantly as well. So, but I, you know, it's a good example of where in dry climates and where we need to deal with water balance issues relative to recycling of water and other aspects, there may be a reason, and I think we should leave open the possibility that wet tailings may be advantageous in those situations still.
Okay.
I think the important thing we have to realize is that the situation in British Columbia and the recommendations in British Columbia certainly are not intended as a one-size-fits-all approach.
Consideration that doesn't make sense.
That needs to be given to site-specific circumstances.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Someone wants to know about long-term liability and how long is long-term liability, meaning that, you know, you can't really just walk away from a solution at a tailings disposal. Do you have any insights on how long long-term liability is?
Well, I will speak to that in more detail tomorrow.
Okay.
I'll leave that kind of as a teaser for tomorrow. But I will suggest to you that certainly present approaches suggesting tens of years, even hundreds of years, probably aren't adequate, particularly if tailings are not completely decommissioned entirely. So, but I will definitely provide more detail on that tomorrow.
Okay, great. Yeah, that sounds good. We got an idea about the Mount Polley tailings disaster. This person asks, what if compartments are built inside the tailings pond such that if there is a breach, only the cells at the breach site will be impacted instead of the whole tailings pond?
Well, my response to that is good idea. I think that's a very good idea. It's something, you know, again, I'd be interested where that idea came from because That's something I haven't necessarily heard a great deal of suggestion of, but immediately in hearing it, it sounds like a very advisable circumstance. Particularly, I would mention, as we get to building these facilities to be so large, going back to you know the slide that's up right now, the issue is we're building engineering structures that while we may have the conceptual capacity to estimate what happens, the reality is we really can't say what we don't know, and it's what we don't know that typically leads to these failures. And so the idea of compartmentalizing the failures, if you will, and that's really what we're talking about, I think that's an excellent idea. It's an approach that we certainly should take as we, again, look at these larger and larger facilities.
Right. Okay. The next question that we have is about dry stacking, and does dry stacking not take contaminants out of a managed facility, and what management practices would you suggest for a dry stack facility?
Well, you know, the dry stack facility is going to require its own individual unique or you know, technology-specific management requirements. Dry stack does not necessarily eliminate in particular geochemical issues. Now, it does remove the tailing supernatant for the most part, but most of our geochemical issues are not related with that tailing supernatant. For example, flotation tailings, typically the flotation supernatant is not a big issue. Cyanide tailings, we can destroy the cyanide, so therefore the supernatant is an issue. But when we stack dry tailings, we still have the issue that if we don't maintain those in a dry state, if you will, we're going to have infiltration occurring. We will have flow through that infiltration, creating exfiltration, and you know again we'll have that issue with seepage coming out of the bottom of dry stack tailings. So I think a particular dry stack does offer advantages from a geotechnical standpoint, no question. Does it offer advantages in dealing with tailing seepage water, particularly over the long term? That's still something I think we're going to have to determine. And it may, in fact, you know, I know a number of mines that have proposed or are undertaking wet closure. Looking at that aspect is something, and the advantages versus disadvantages is something we definitely need to give some thought to.
Okay, great. We're getting another number of comments just saying thank you so much for this very informational seminar. So I just wanted to state that and let you know that you're getting a lot of compliments. So thank you for providing that feedback.
My pleasure.
We got a participant who wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit more about the disadvantages of line systems.
Yeah, you know, I want to be clear. I don't want to just emphasize the disadvantages of line systems. They can be advantageous in that we, you know, basically keep seepage out of groundwater and surface water resources by doing it. The problem with line systems or the disadvantages really are that, you know, first and foremost, liners leak. I've had opportunity during the course of my professional career to be responsible for construction liners, do liner construction, provide oversight, inspections, all kinds of things. I've had opportunities to use different methods, chemical welding methods, heat welding methods, various other things. Despite every effort that I've seen, and those efforts have been heroic on the part of the mining industry in some cases, to construct facilities that won't leak, they almost inevitably do. And EPA has a similar experience with respect to repositories that are constructed as line facilities. And so we have to respect that seepage is going to occur from these facilities. And when you look at it, the cost in many cases of installing the liner compared to, say, for example, and then I should say installing the liner and then dealing with accidental seepage, in many cases would not be greater than that if they'd originally gone to either paste or dry tailings. So the advantages of, and I should mention that tomorrow I'll go into it a bit more, excuse me, but the other big problem with mine tailings, or disadvantage, if you will, is with respect to closure. We really want tailings to be maintained in an unsaturated state at closure, and we want that situation not to change. When we put tailings inside of a bathtub, with the liner, then we really are presented with challenges in terms of maintaining that unsaturated state. We need to install whip drains, puncture the liner, maintain the system, and do other things. So I think liners certainly have an application and are appropriate in particular circumstances, but at the same time, they're less than ideal, and really, in the long term, they're something we should try to avoid if we can at all.
Okay. All right. We have a couple more questions. This participant asks if have FLMAs made any changes in how they evaluate TSS in response to Mount Polley?
So folks not familiar with the language, FLMA, I believe, stands for Federal Land Management Agency. And, of course, TSS is tailings storage facilities. To my knowledge, the regulators, in particular federal regulators in the United States, have not made any changes relative to Mount Polley. To my knowledge, there have been no other regulators, state or otherwise, that have yet made any changes either. I do know that folks, for example, in Montana have considered some regulatory changes. However, I don't believe that actually succeeded this year, but hopefully will soon. And then elsewhere, I know they're considering regulatory changes, although, for example, in British Columbia, even though they would expect to be at the forefront of this, I haven't heard anything from them as to what they're considering. So it's early. The event, and in particular the expert panel report, has been out less than 6 months now. There is, I might mention to folks who aren't aware, there will be another report that comes out that includes similar investigative information and then more that's been conducted by Clone Crittenger Berger, KCB, on behalf of the British Columbia Ministry of Mines for the purpose of looking at the more I guess untasteful, but you know, criminal perhaps aspects of that failure. And once that information is available and comes out, I would hope, expect folks like the British Columbia government to suggest regulatory changes shortly thereafter.
Okay.
That report is supposed to come out in June. I at this point don't have verification as to exactly how it's going to come out.
Okay, and there are a number more questions. If you're willing to take some more questions, I can keep going.
I'll go as long as my voice holds in there.
Okay, all right. Well, you let me know. This participant wants to know if you have any recommendations for design storm events, including short-term, such as a 24-hour storm, or a longer-term, which could be a wet period over months.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's a very common question and an aspect that I run into you know, very frequently. You know, the common type events that I see projected out there are 25-year storm events for stormwater. And then in terms of containment of processed water and other things, we look at 100-year events. In my job representing regulators, First Nations, tribes, public interest organizations, and others, the approach that I take is one of simply being more conservative, and in particular recognizing that from a public perspective, when our engineering designs fail, regardless of what type of event occurs, the perception upon our professional ability is very negative. And in my experience, the sensitivity of designing, for example, from a 2,500-year to 100-year event, at most locations, that's not a great deal of cost. And so upping the ante to do that really is something that I don't understand why it's not more frequently undertaken by industry rather than something we have to suggest either as the public or regulators that they need to up that ante. Now, as far as specific recommendations, I think we have to consider climate change, whether we believe in it or not, when we talk about storm events as we go forward. During my, what I describe as a brief lifetime, I've seen far, far too many situations at mine sites where events that are projected to occur once in 100 years literally are occurring every 5 years, every 10 years, or you know, in that range, simply shows me we're not accurate. So going forward, I think we need to do things like take our typical 25-year stormwater events and increase those for sedimentation and other purposes to 100-year events. I think we need to take a look at using 500-year events as a standard when it comes to controlling process waters and other critical containment structures. I know that may not be popular with my fellow engineers and certainly with industry, but I strongly believe that if we would undertake these measures, the confidence and frequency of incidences that question that confidence would decrease.
Okay.
Confidence increase, the frequency decrease. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that would make sense. Someone wants to know if the video of the Mount Polly figure is available for download or somewhere online.
Yes, there's a couple of different sources. One, if you go to the Mount Polly Independent Review Panel website, and I know if you just simply search that Mount Polly Independent Review Panel, you'll get to that website very quickly. There's a video contained at that website, but then also if you just do a search on Mount Polly video, you should be able to link into the news station that sent the helicopter out. And that particular video is approximately 5 minutes, and it also shows, in addition to quite a bit of video of the breach, video of the downstream impacts. And so for those of you interested in seeing what a catastrophic breach can do to the environment, you'll definitely want to take a look at that video, as it is incredibly descriptive and shows, you know, an actual catastrophic event happening, which, again, I don't know any of us that have had that opportunity to actually view that before.
Okay. Let's see what else we have going on here in the question pod. Someone wants to know if recent failures can be compared to the Church Rock mine failure. Do you know anything about that?
I do know a bit about that. Unfortunately, I can't say I'm as familiar as I wish I was to discuss that in detail. But yes, you know, the short answer is yes, the Church Rock failure, which I believe they're talking about a failure that occurred at a uranium mine, has similarities, as almost do all these failures, to what occurred at Mount Polly. Again, as I recall, that failure, though, had a particular aspect of human failure to do what was required in the operation of that facility, as well as it not being designed for the type of event that occurred.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question from a participant here. The comments, that I guess people were really interested in the comments that you made about climate change, and they were just wondering if you have published your design considerations anywhere that would be accessible for folks to reference.
You know, I don't really know that I have. I would have to review some different documents that I provided input to. I do a lot of work in collaboration with folks in the industry, and I will say that there certainly is not agreement on those criteria. But for those who would like a bit more information, description of them, send me an email, and I'd be more than glad to reply and provide you my recommendations in that forum or format.
Okay, yeah, I think that sounds great. Like I said, Jim's contact information is available with the webinar seminar page, so you can get in touch with him from that source if you can't find his information. This is great. Well, thank you, Jim, for joining us today. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and this is a lot of interaction with our participants, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about, you know, what mine tailings are and how they're stored and what can go wrong and what are some of the best practices. And I know we're definitely looking forward to hearing you talk to more tomorrow about closure of these facilities, along with Bill Albright, who's going to talk about final covers. And I think this would be a really great complement to what you presented today. So thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you, and thanks, everybody, for joining.
Yeah, thank you. And then I just wanted to ask John Hillenbrand from Region 9 if there were any comments or any remarks that you would like to make before I turn the closure of the webinar over to Gene Vallant.
No, I have none. I appreciate Jim's coverage.
Great, great. Yeah, I'm going to look forward to having John and Jim and Bill present tomorrow on our day two of this webinar. So with that, I think we're ready to move over to closing out today's session, and I want to thank everyone again for their time and attendance, and I really look forward to hearing more about this topic tomorrow and having all of you participate and submitting your questions, because that really makes this very interactive, and just to talk about different ideas that people have and clarify some of the issues that our presenters are making. So again, this is part of today's webinar was part of a series. Our second part of this Mind Tailings webinar will be tomorrow at the same time. And I also want to let everyone know that we now have registration open for the next webinar in this mining series, where we're going to have three presenters talk about soil remediation and phytotechnologies at the Anaconda Smelter site. So I'll encourage you to follow the link here and participate in that webinar also. And also, you can go to the Cluin.org mining and events page for more details of upcoming events related to mining remediation and site reuse. So I encourage you to check out that website. And with that, I think I'm going to turn things over to Gene Vallant to close us out on this Cluin webinar.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I'm just going to walk the audience through a few final reminders before we shut everything down for today's session. If you're interested in learning about our upcoming webinar opportunities or other resources, as well as archive sessions and interactive conferences and other events that we have taking place, I encourage you to stay connected with us here at the Cleanup Information Network. Our homepage is at www.cluin.org, but you can also find us and either follow or like or retweet or join our LinkedIn groups. Again, we're on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Our links to those social professional networking sites are posted on this slide. Many participants use our webinars to meet particular training requirements that they have. We do get a number of requests for training records. I just wanted to remind the audience, we have an online automated lookup tool. If you visit the following site and enter in your email address and then click that Submit Request button, we will automatically send you a table by email which lists all of the live webinars that you actually checked in for and participated live. If you have changed jobs, remember, or you have multiple email addresses that you've used, you may need to use all of those. But if you need additional help in documenting your participation, you can feel free to contact me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov. As noted, the presentation materials, along with a whole collection of resources, are available on the seminar links or resources page. For those of you who happen to be watching this recorded webinar, you'll find all of those available on the middle right of your screen in the related URLs window. Those links will remain active from this point forward, so you can still get to them, whether you're here live or you're replaying the archived version. If you are looking to, again, download the slides, you'll find that on the seminar links or resources page. I would ask each of you to take a moment and fill out our online feedback form. We do count on your individual responses on these forms to help us continue to deliver online seminars like this one. So please take a moment to fill it out. If you joined with multiple people at your location, each person can actually fill out their own feedback form. The form will be active from this point forward. So again, those of you replaying the archived version can also share your thoughts based off of the feedback form from the links in the related URLs pod. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation during today's session, we are not yet generating certificates, but we do have a confirmation email that can be sent based off of your feedback form. submission. So as shown on the screen, there's a box on that feedback form that I've got circled in red on this picture. If you check that box and you make sure your email address is entered correctly and you submit feedback, we will send you an automated confirmation email which at least verifies that you shared feedback after the live delivery. Those of you looking to document for CEUs or PDHs, usually if you save your registration or reminder emails, have a copy of the presentation materials or the seminar homepage, and have one of these confirmation emails, that's enough to document your attendance for your accrediting institution. But I encourage you to check with your local organization to see what they need to document your participation. As I noted today, our session was recorded and will be available for free archive and replay. I'm going to work to try to get this archive up as soon as I can, but I do not believe it'll be up in time for tomorrow's session, but as noted, the two can be taken separately. You will receive an automated email as soon as the archive is available for free replay, and I encourage you to share it with those that you think will find it to be a valuable expenditure of their time. So hopefully you'll all be joining us for tomorrow with part two of this webinar series. I want to send my gratitude to our instructors who joined us for today's session and the nearly 170 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We hope that this has been a valuable expenditure of your time.